USFS 1919. The Ranger, the Cook, and a Hole in the Sky. And then he thinks he knows the hills where his life rose. Matthew Arnold, The Buried Life. I was young, and I thought I was tough, and I knew it was beautiful, and I was a little bit crazy but hadn't noticed it yet. Outside the ranger station, there were more mountains in all directions than I was ever to see again. Oceans of mountains. And inside the station at this particular moment, I was ahead in a game of cribbage with a ranger of the Elk Summit District of the Selway Forest of the United States Forest Service, USFS, which was even younger than I was and enjoyed many of the same characteristics. It was mid-August of 1919, so I was 17, and the Forest Service was only 14. Since of several possible birthdays for the Forest Service, I picked 1905, when the Forest Division of the Department of the Interior was transferred to the Department of Agriculture and named the United States Forest Service. In 1919, it was 28 miles from the Elk Summit Ranger Station of the Selway Forest to the nearest road, 14 miles to the top of the Bitterroot Divide, and 14 straight down Blodgett Canyon to the Bitterroot Valley, only a few miles from Hamilton, Montana. The 14 miles going down were as cruel as the 14 going up, and far more dangerous, since Blodgett Canyon was medically famous for the tick that gave Rocky Mountain fever, with one chance out of five for recovery. The 28-mile trail from Elk Summit to the mouth of Blodgett Canyon was a Forest Service trail, and therefore marked by a blaze with a notch on top. Only a few other trails in the vast Elk Summit district were so marked. Otherwise, there were only game trails and old trappers' trails that gave out on open ridges and meadows with no signs of where the game or trappers had vanished. It was a world of strings of pack horses or men who walked alone, a world of hoof and foot and the rest done by hand. 1919, across the Bitterroot Divide in northern Idaho, was just before the end of most of history, that it had no four-wheel drives, no bulldozers, no power saws, and nothing pneumatic to take the place of jackhammers, and nothing chemical or airborne to put out forest fires. Nowadays, you can scarcely be a lookout without a uniform and a college degree. But in 1919, not a man in our outfit, least of all the ranger himself, had been to college. They still picked rangers for the Forest Service by picking the toughest guy in town. Ours, Bill Bell, was the toughest in the Bitterroot Valley, and we thought he was the best ranger in the Forest Service. We were strengthened in this belief by the rumor that Bill had killed a sheep herder. We were a little disappointed that he had been acquitted of the charges, but nobody held it against him, for we all knew that being acquitted of killing a sheep herder in Montana isn't the same as being innocent. As for a uniform, our ranger always wore his .45, and most of our regular crew also packed revolvers, including me. The two old men in the outfit told the rest of us that USFS stood for User Slow and Fucker Fast. Being young and literal, I put up an argument at first, pointing out that the beginning letters in their motto didn't exactly fit USFS, that their last word, fast, didn't begin with an S, as service did. In fact, being thick-headed, I stuck with this argument quite a while, and could hear my voice rise. Each time, they spit through the parting in their mustaches and looked at me as if I were too young to say anything that would have any bearing on such a subject. As far as they were concerned, their motto fitted the United States Forest Service exactly, and by the end of the summer, I came to share their opinion. Although our ranger, Bill Bell, was the best, he did not shine at cribbage. He put down his cards and said, 15-2, 15-4, 15-6, and a pair or eight. As usual, I spread out his hand and counted after him. All he had was an eight and a pair of sevens, a hand he always counted as eight. Maybe the eight card gave him the idea. Bill, I told him, that's a six hand. 15-2, 15-4, and a pair are 6. Being wrong always made Bill Bell feel somebody was insulting him. "Damn it," he said. "Can't you see that 8 card? Well, 8 plus 7. The cook, still wiping dishes, looked over Bill's shoulder and said, "That's a 6 hand." Bill folded up his cards and tossed them into the pile. Whatever the cook said was always right with Bill, which didn't make me like the cook any better. It is always hard to like a spoiled cook, and I disliked this one particularly. Even so, I had no idea how much I was going to dislike him before the summer was over, or for that matter, how big a thing another card game was going to be. By the middle of that summer, when I was 17, I had yet to see myself become part of a story. I had as yet no notion that life, every now and then, becomes literature. Not for long, of course, but long enough to be what we best remember, and often enough so that what we eventually come to mean by life are those moments when life, instead of going sideways, backwards, forward, or nowhere at all, lines out straight, tense and inevitable, with a complication, climax, and, given some luck, a purgation, as if life had been made and not happened. Right then, though, I wasn't thinking of Bill as being the hero of any story. I was just getting tired of waiting for him to make the next deal. Before he did, he licked his finger so he wouldn't deal 2 or 3 cards at a time. It was hard to figure out how Bill could be so different when he had a rope in his hands. With a rope, he was an artist, and he usually was doing something with one. Even when he was sitting in the ranger station, he would whirl little loops and dab them over a chair. Either that or tie knots, beautiful knots. While the crew talked, he threw loops or tied knots. He was a sort of yeah or no guy to human beings. Now and then he talked part of a sentence or a sentence or two. But to his horses and mules he talked all the time, and they understood him. He never talked loud to them, especially not to mules, which he knew were like elephants and never forget. If a mule got balky when he was shoeing him, he never reached for anything. He just let him out in the sun and tied up one front foot and let him stand there for a couple of hours. You can't imagine what a Christianizing effect it has, even on a mule, to stand for a couple of hours in the hot sun minus a foot. Bill was built to fit his hands. He was big all over. Primarily, he was a horseman, and he needed an extra-large horse. He was not the slender cowboy of the movies and the plains. He was a horseman of the mountains. He could swing an axe or pull a saw, run a transit and build trail, walk all day if he had to, put on climbing spurs and string number 9 telephone wire, and he wasn't a bad cook. In the mountains, you work to live. And in the mountains, you don't care much whether your horse can run fast. Where's he going to run? Bill's horse was big and long striding and could walk all day over mountain trails at 5 miles an hour. He was a mountain horse carrying a mountain man. Bill called him Big Moose. He was brown and walked with his head thrown back as if he wore horns. Every profession has a pinnacle to its art. In the hospital, it is the brain or heart surgeon. And in the sawmill, it is the sawyer, who with squinting eyes makes the first major cut that turns a log into boards. In the early Forest Service, our major artist was the packer, as it has usually been in worlds where there are no roads. Packing is an art as old as the first time man moved and had an animal to help him carry his belongings. As such, it came ultimately from Asia, and from there across northern Africa and Spain, and then up from Mexico, and to us, probably from Indian squaws. You can't even talk to a packer unless you know what a cincha, is, a latigo, and a manti, manta. With the coming of roads, this ancient art has become almost a lost art. But in the early part of this century, there were still few roads across the mountains, and none across the Bitterroot Wall. From the mouth of Blodgett Canyon near Hamilton, Montana, to our ranger station at Elk Summit in Idaho, nothing moved except on foot. When there was a big fire crew to be supplied, There could be as many as 50 mules and short-backed horses, heaving and grunting up the narrow switchbacks and dropping extra-large amounts of manure at the sharp turns. The ropes tying the animals together would jerk taut and stretch their connected necks into a straight line until they looked like dark, gigantic swans circling and finally disappearing into a higher medium. Bill was our head packer, and the Forest Service never had a better one. But right now, he was having a hard time figuring out which of his three remaining cards he should play. He would like to have taken off his black Stetson and scratched his head. But the first thing he did when he dressed in the morning was to put on his black hat, and it was the last thing he took off when he went to bed. In between, he did not like to remove it. Before he got around to pushing it back on his head and playing a card, I found myself thinking of some of the trips I had taken with him across the Bitterroot Divide. As head packer, Bill rode in front of the string, a study in angles. With black Stetson hat at a slant, he rode with his head turned almost backward from his body so he could watch to see if any of the packs were working loose. Later in life, I was to see Egyptian bas-reliefs, where the heads of men are looking one way and their bodies are going another. And so it is with good packers. After all, packing is the art of balancing packs and then seeing that they ride evenly. Otherwise, the animals will have saddle sores in a day or two and be out of business for all or most of the summer. Up there in front with Bill, you could see just about anything happen. A horse might slip or get kicked out of the string and roll frightened downhill until he got tangled around a tree trunk. You might even have to shoot him, collect the saddle, and forget the rest of what was scattered over the landscape. But mostly what you were watching for took Bill's trained eye to see. A saddle that had slipped back so far the animal couldn't breathe, or a saddle that had slipped sideways. In an outfit that large, there are always a few shad bellies that no cinch can hang on to, and quite a few bloaters that blow up in the morning when the cinch touches them and then slowly deflate. Who knows what? The trouble may have started back in the warehouse, where the load cargoer couldn't tell weight or didn't give a damn, and now an animal was trying to keep steady across the Bitterroot Divide with lopsided packs. Or maybe the packs balanced, but some assistant packer had tied one higher than the other. Or had tied a sloppy diamond hitch and everything slipped. The Bitterroot Divide, with its many switchbacks, granite boulders, and bog holes, brought out every weakness in a packer, his equipment, and his animals. To take a pack string of nearly 50 across the Bitterroot Divide was to perform a masterpiece in that now almost lost art. And in 1919, I rode with Bill Bell and saw it done. The divide was just as beautiful as the way up. In August, it was blue with June lupine. Froth dropped off the jaws of the horses and mules, and snorting through enlarged red nostrils, the animals shook their saddles, trying without hands to rearrange their loads. Not far to the south was El Capitan, always in snow and always living up to its name. Ahead and to the west was our ranger station, and the mountains of Idaho. Poems of geology, stretching beyond any boundaries and seemingly even beyond the world. 6 miles or so west of the divide is a lake, roughly two-thirds of the way between Hamilton and Elk Summit. That is the only place where there is water and enough grass to hold a big bunch of horses overnight. K.D. Swan, the fine photographer of the early Forest Service, should have been there to record the design of the divide, ascending in triangles to the sky, and descending in ovals and circles to an oval meadow and an oval lake with a moose knee-deep beside lily pads. It was triangles going up and ovals coming down, and on the divide it was springtime in August. The unpacking was just as beautiful. One wet satin back after another, without saddle or saddle sore, and not a spot of white, wet flesh where hair and hide had been rubbed off. Perhaps one has to know something about keeping packs balanced on the backs of animals to think this beautiful, or to notice it at all. But to all of those who work come moments of beauty unseen by the rest of the world. So, to a horseman who has to start looking for horses before daybreak, nothing is so beautiful in darkness as the sound of a bell mare. While I was sitting there thinking of how Bill was a major artist and how even the Nazi tide were artistic, he had somehow got ahead of me in the cribbage game, at which he was a chump. At least I was a lot better than he was at cribbage, once the favorite indoor pastime of the woods. We even played it outdoors. And often on the trail, one of us would carry a deck of cards and a cribbage board in his pack sack. And in the middle of the morning and afternoon, we would straddle a log and have a game. Bill really wasn't ahead, but I was going to lose unless he played like a Chinaman. We both were in striking distance of 121, which is the end of the game in cribbage, and I had the advantage of counting first. I needed only 8 points, which normally I should have been able to make with a decent hand plus the pegging. But I had a lousy hand, just a pair of fours, and a pair is worth only 2 points. So I would have to peg 6 to make 121, and that's a lot. In case you don't know cribbage, about all Bill had to do to stop me from pegging 6 was not to pair anything I put down. I started the pegging by playing one of my fours, and so help me, he had a 4 in his hand and he snapped it down. "I'll take 2 for a pair of fours," he said. As I told you, all I had in my hand was a pair of fours. I put down the 3rd 4, and in cribbage, 3 of a kind counts 6, so I had 121 in the ball game. And a start toward discovering that somehow artists aren't sharp at cards. Actually, I had heard rumors in Hamilton, which was Bill's headquarters in the Bitterroot Valley, that the local small-town gamblers could hardly wait for Bill to get his monthly check. Among the local housemen and shills, he was supposedly noted for playing poker as if he breathed through gills. Knowing how Bill hated to lose, I was somewhat surprised that he hadn't also been acquitted of shooting a shill. Knowing Bill, I also knew that he was sore at me, at least for the moment, so I thought, let's see if a change of games won't change the luck. Now, of course, 3 can play a lot more card games than 2. As the cook was finishing dishes, I asked him, "Why don't you cut in on a nickel-and-dime game? Poker? Pinochle? You and Bill, name it." I'll never forget that cook. In fact, he was to become one of my longest memories. Even out in the woods, he wore low canvas shoes. He turned his shoes toward me and said, "I never play cards against the men I work with." This wasn't the first time the cook had made this stately speech to me, so I started disliking him all over again. His name may have been Hawkins, but I really think it was Hawks. And in memory, I made it into Hawkins because in some book there was a character I didn't like by the name of Hawkins. Bill and I played one more game of cribbage, trying to get over being sore, but we weren't successful. I picked up the cards and put them in their case, and the case on the only shelf in the cabin. Before I reached the door, the cook had picked them up and was sitting at the table shuffling. He dealt out 4 hands. Then he went around the first 3 hands again, quickly giving each hand 1 or 2 cards, as if each hand had asked to draw. He paused, however, before giving himself cards. Then with one motion, he picked them all up. After shuffling, he dealt out 5 hands, sometimes 4, never 3, lest I get the idea that he would play with Bill and me. I stood there watching him shuffling and dealing. It was worth watching. After about 5 minutes, he picked up all the cards with one swoop, stuck them in the case and the case on the shelf, and started for bed. I closed the door and started for the tent where the crew slept. I liked him less than ever. There were only 4 of us in the regular crew, plus the lookouts who were stationed on the high peaks, plus the ranger and the cook. The regular crew was hired by the month, $60 per, for the summer. The ranger was the only one in the district who was hired all year. Earlier in the season, there had been a big fire in the district, and an emergency crew of over 100 men had been hired on the streets of Butte and Spokane. But the fire had been put out, and the emergency crew sent back to town. Our small regular crew now was building trail about 3 miles from the station. Grade A trail, too, with about a 20-foot right-of-way and no more than a 6% grade. A 20-foot swath through the wilderness with no trees or brush left standing, and instead of going over an outcropping of rocks with a short, steep pitch in the trail, we blasted through the rocks to keep the trail from gaining more than 6 feet of altitude every 100 feet. Tons of dynamite, and we could have taken a hay wagon down our mountain boulevard. Of course, all we needed were trails wide enough to get pack horses through without the packs getting caught between trees. And in a few years, the Forest Service revised the specifications and gave orders for the backcountry to be opened with as many trails as possible. Still, it is proper when young to strive for gigantic perfection that doesn't make sense. And today, somewhere in the jungles of Idaho, is a mile or two of overgrown boulevard leading nowhere, not even to a deserted Mayan temple. Of the regular crew of four, two were old men and two were young punks. There was Mr. McBride and his red-headed son. Mr. McBride was a jack-of-all-trades who had worked at different ranches in the Bitterroot Valley, and his son was trying to be like his father. Mr. Smith was the old man of the crew and was always worried about his bowels. He was addressed as Mr. Smith. He was dignified and took small, aged steps on large legs that made his feet look tiny. He had been a miner, and he naturally was our powder man, and a good one. Since there were four of us and Mr. McBride had a son, Mr. Smith looked upon me as his. That's how I was elected to the dynamite, which made me sick. Before I had started the job, I had heard stories that if you touch dynamite and then your face, you will get a headache. Maybe I was carried away by the story, because as long as I worked on the powder, I always had headaches. Maybe, though, at 17, I wasn't quite big enough to swing a double jackhammer all day. When you were blasting, naturally you first make a hole in the rock for your powder. Nowadays it is done with a pneumatic drill. Then it was done by hand and jackhammer. If you worked in a team of two, it was called double jacking. One man held the drill, and every time the other man hit the head of it with the jackhammer, the man holding the drill would turn it slightly until the bit completed a circle. This was the outline for the hole. And the same thing went on until the hole was dug, stopping only when the man holding the drill said, "Mud." Then the hammer man gratefully rested, while the man holding the drill took a very small dipper and cleaned out the hole. Otherwise, the man with the hammer kept swinging. And if by chance just once he missed the small head of the drill, and the hammer glanced off, he would mutilate the hand or arm of the man holding the drill. Sometimes it seemed that Mr. Smith had forgotten how to say mud, and I would look down and see the heads of two or three drills, on each of which Mr. Smith had the same hand, the skin of which was already freckled by age. I no longer think that rubbing my face gave me the headaches. This morning the headache started earlier than usual. I can't give you any very clear reason why I disliked the cook so much. I was honest enough with myself to say that I might be jealous of him. Although I was only 17, this was my third summer in the Forest Service, two of them working for Bill. And he had started to show me how to pack, and in return I would do him favors like coming back to camp in the morning to pack out lunch to the crew. I couldn't figure how this cook had moved into first place. Everything he said or did was just perfect as far as Bill was concerned. Besides, I didn't like his looks. He looked like a blue jay, cocky, with his head on a slant and a tuft of hair on top of it. A blue jay with low canvas shoes. Mostly, though, I didn't need reasons to dislike him. When you get older, you become rational, more or less, but when you're young, you know. I knew this cook was a 40-cent piece. It wasn't helping my headache either to think of the ranger being sore at me. I said to myself, take it easy and keep your big mouth shut. It's nothing and it'll blow over. Then I repeated to myself, keep your big mouth shut. But I knew I wouldn't. I had formed principles to compensate for having started work when I was 15. I'd missed a lot, I knew. The swimming hole, summer girls, and a game called tennis, which was played in white flannels with cuffs. I would say to myself, You decided to go into the woods. It's the least you can do is be tough. I hadn't felt this way at 15 when I first worked for Bill, but that was the way I felt now at 17. Even though Bill was my model and an artist, maybe because he was, at 17, something in me was half looking for trouble with him. Before noon, who should come along but the cook, packing our lunch? He said to me, "The ranger wants you to come back to camp after you eat." When I got back to camp, Bill was in the cabin we used as a warehouse, building the packs for the string that was going to Hamilton soon. I didn't ask him why he'd sent for me, and he didn't say. I just started helping him build and balance the packs, and tried to keep my mind on what I was doing, partly because building packs is never a mechanical job. Not even when you're packing the simplest stuff, like tin cans, which go into boxes called panniers, made of rawhide, wood, or canvas, that are hung on the prongs of the saddle. You can't forget to wrap each can in toilet paper, or the labels on the cans will rub off, and you won't be able to tell peaches from peas. And the heaviest cans have to go to the bottom, or the pack will shift. Then each of the two side packs has to weigh the same, and together, with the top pack, they shouldn't weigh more than 175 pounds for a horse, or 225 for a mule. At least those were the Forest Service regulations then. But they were 25 pounds too heavy if the animals weren't to be bone heaps by the middle of the summer. I don't care who you are. I'll bet you that without a scale, you can't build two packs weighing the same and together weighing 150 or 200 pounds when a top pack has been added. After we had packed for a while, I forgot to wonder why the ranger had sent for me. Maybe it was just to help him box things up. Then, while we were working with our heads bent, I heard the cook come by jingling the knives and forks the crew had used for lunch. Still working on a pack, I heard myself say, "I don't like that son of a bitch." Bill lifted a pack and put it down. Inside, I heard myself say, "Keep your big mouth shut." Outside, I heard myself add, "Someday I'm going to punch the piss out of him." Bill stood up and said, "Not in this district, you won't." He looked at me for a long time. And I looked back, still crouched over my pack. I figured that at this moment, crouching was a good position. Finally, we both went back to work. Bending and lifting, he began to tell me about how the morning had gone. "The lookout on Grave Peak quit this morning." "Yeah," I said. "Yeah," he said. "He came off that mountain in about 3 jumps. It was nearly 12 miles to the top of the peak. "You know what he said to me?" he asked. "No," I said. I wasn't happy about how this was going to end. "The lookout said, 'Give me my time. This is too tough a job for me, fighting fire in the day and sleeping with rattlesnakes at night.'" After lifting the pack again for weight, he went on, "Seems that he put his hand on the bed to pull back the blanket, and he felt something shaped like a fire hose. If you believe it." At Bear Creek, where I first worked for Bill, there had been a lot of rattlers on those bare mountainsides. On a steep side hill trail, the upside can be as high as your hand, so you could almost brush those rattlesnakes as you swung along. And being cold-blooded, they could be attracted to the warmth of a bed at night. But I hadn't seen a rattlesnake this summer in Elk Summit, although it was the adjoining district. "No, I don't believe it," I said. "Why not?" he asked. "It's too high up there for rattlesnakes," I said. "You sure?" he asked. And I told him I wasn't sure, but I thought so. Still working with the packs, he said, "Why don't you go up on the lookout for a couple of weeks and find out?" I didn't ask him when. I knew he meant now. I lifted the two packs until I thought they were balanced and then started for the door. He added, "If you spot any fires, call them in. And if there's a big rain or snow, close up camp and come back to the station." I knew it would be dark before I got to Grave Peak, so I asked the cook to make me a sandwich. I had a big blue bandana handkerchief, and I put the sandwich in the handkerchief and tied the handkerchief to my belt in the middle of my back. Picked up my razor, toothbrush and comb, and my favorite axe and carborundum stone. Then I strapped on my .32-20 and started up the high trail. I knew I had been sent into exile. It was 12 miles and all up, but I never stopped to rest or eat the sandwich. Bill seemed to be watching all the time. By walking hard, I kept even with daylight until near the end. Then darkness passed over me from below. Just the dazzling peak above me told me where I was going. For the first few days, I was too tired to think about my troubles. I was still half sick from the dynamite, and I still dragged from that big fire we'd fought in late July. So I spent most of my time just looking the place over and getting things squared away. Modern lookouts live on top of their peaks in what are called bird cages, glass houses on towers with lightning rods twisted around them so that the lookouts are not afraid of lightning striking them, and for 24 hours a day can remain on the towers to watch for lightning to strike and smoke to appear. This, of course, is the way it should be. But in 1919, bird cages, as far as we knew, were only for birds. We watched from the open peak and lived in a tent in a basin close to the peak, where usually there was a spring of water. From my camp to the lookout was a good half-hour climb, and I spent about 12 hours a day watching mountains. Near the top there were few trees, and nearly all of them had been struck by lightning. It had gone around them like a snake of fire. But I was to discover that on a high mountain, lightning does not seem to strike from the sky. On a high mountain, lightning seems to start somewhat below you and very close by, seemingly striking upward and outward. Once it was to knock me down, toss branches over me, and leave me sick. The basin where my tent was pitched was covered with chunks of cliff that had toppled from above. I did not see a rattlesnake, but I shared the basin with a grizzly bear, who occasionally came along flipping over fallen pieces of disintegrated cliff as he looked for disproportionately small grubs. When I saw him coming, I climbed the highest rock and tried to figure out how many hundreds of grubs he had to eat for a square meal. When he saw me, he made noises in his mouth, as if he were shifting his false teeth. In a thicket on top of a jack pine, I found the skeleton of a deer. Your guess is as good as mine. Mine is that the snow in the high basin was deep enough to cover the trees, and the deer was crossing the crust and broke through or was killed, and eventually the snow melted. There was a tear in my tent, so when it rained I could keep either my food or my bed dry, but not both. Since this was not my first hitch as a lookout, I knew what to watch for. A little cloud coming up a big mountain. Usually in the late afternoon when the dews had long dried and the winds were at their height. And usually it detached itself from the mountain and went on up into the sky and became just a little cloud. Once in a while it would disappear on the mountain, and then you didn't know what you had seen. Probably a cloud, but maybe a puff of smoke, and the wind had changed and you couldn't see it now. So you marked it on your map to watch for several days. In a lightning storm, you marked every strike to watch, and sometimes it was a week later before one of them became a little cloud again, and then got bigger and began to boil. When a cloud began to boil, then it wasn't a cloud, especially if it reflected red on the bottom. It could mean fire even when the cloud was 2 or 3 miles down the canyon from where it was first seen, because if there were no wind, smoke could drift a long way behind a ridge before rising again where it would show. So that's the way a fire first looks to a lookout. Something, you don't know what, usually in late afternoon, that may go away and not come again. And if it comes back and is smoke, it may be quite a long way from the fire. A possible late afternoon cloud has no resemblance to what a fire looks like if it gets out of control. And it was often impossible in those early years to get men quickly on a fire when it was in the backcountry where there were no roads, and sometimes not even trails. And of course, long before there were planes stationed in Missoula ready to drop chemicals and smoke jumpers. Instead, when a fire got out of control, the Forest Service hired 100 or so bindle stiffs off the streets of Butte or Spokane at 30 cents an hour, 45 cents for straw bosses. Shipped them to some rail station near the end of a branch line, and walked them the final 35 or 40 miles over the wall. By the time they reached the fire, it had spread all over the map, and it jumped into the crowns of trees, and for a lot of years, a prospective ranger taking his exam had said the last word on crown fires. Even by my time, he was a legend. When asked on his examination, "What do you do when a fire crowns?" he had answered, "Get out of the way and pray like hell for rain." Our big fire that summer had been big enough so that I was still tired, and my eyes still ached from smoke and no sleep, and big enough so that for years it crowned in my dreams. But it wasn't in the class of those fires of 1910 that burned out the Coeur d'Alene and great pieces of the Bitterroot. The smoke from those fires drifted 700 miles to Denver, and in my hometown of Missoula, the streetlights had to be turned on in the middle of the afternoon, and curled ashes brushed softly against the lamps, as if snow were falling heavily in the heat of August. Of course, no other fires on record were as big as those of 1910, but the one of 1919 was the biggest I was ever on. It came in a rage and a crown to the top of the ridge. You may know, when a fire gets big enough, it generates its own wind. The heat from the fire lightens the air, which rises in the sky, and the cooler air from above swoops down to replace it. And soon a great circular storm enrages the fire, and the sky is a volcanic eruption of burning cones and branches descending in streamers of flames. The fire stands on the ridge, roaring for hell to arrive as reinforcement. While you are trying to peer through it to see the inferno on its way, suddenly somebody yells, "God, look behind! The son of a bitch has jumped the gulch!" 180 degrees from where you have been looking for the inferno, and halfway up the opposite ravine, a small smoke is growing big, where one of those burning cones or branches dropped out of the sky and trapped you with a fire in your rear. Then what do you do? Of course, the men who had been brought in from Butte or Spokane were dead tired and barefoot long before they reached the fire. At the hiring hall in Butte and Spokane, each had to have a good pair of boots and a jacket to be employed, so they took turns in the alley changing the one good pair they had. Now all but one of them had marched across the Bitterroot Wall in poor street shoes, and not being able to keep ahead of the pack train, they ate 28 miles of dust. They were bums off the street, miners out of the holes for the summer with the hope of avoiding tuberculosis, winos and industrial workers of the world, who had been thick in Butte and Spokane during World War I. Since it was only the summer after the war, we ordinary working stiffs were still pretty suspicious of IWWs. Those of us who belonged to the regular crew, that is, who were paid $60 a month instead of 30 cents an hour, said that IWW meant, "I won't work." And we were also sure that they were happy to see our country burn. For whatever reason, we had to spend as much time patrolling them as we did the fire. First, we had to get them to the top of the opposite ridge before the new fire arrived there. And a lot of them only wanted to lie down and go to sleep with the great fire coming from behind. It was the first time I ever saw that sometimes death has no meaning to men if they can lie down and sleep. We kicked them up the hill while they begged to be left lying where they were, and we beat the new fire to the top. Then we made a fire trench, just a scraping 2 or 3 feet wide to remove anything that would burn, like dry needles or duff. In front of the fire trench, we built piles of dry twigs, and then we waited for the wind to turn and blow back toward the new fire coming up the side of the ravine. We waited till the foreman gave us the signal before we lit the piles of twigs and sent fires burning back into the main one. This is known as backfiring, and for once it worked. Although if the wind had shifted again to its original direction, all we would have done was give the fire a head start on us. We did not sleep for 3 days. Some of us had to carry drinking water in warm canvas sacks up a 1,000-foot ridge. The rest of us slowly extended the fire trench down the sides of the fire. The bottom of it we let go for a while. A fire doesn't go very far or fast downhill. We had done a good job in heading off the fire. What you do in the first couple of hours after you hit a fire is what counts. And if it isn't right, you had better take that young ranger's advice and give yourself over to prayer. Bill and the man he had made fire foreman had both experience and gift. And it takes gift, as well as having been there before, to know where to hit a fire hard enough to turn it in its tracks. When it's less than 110 degrees and nothing is about to burn you to death or roar at you, and your lungs will still breathe the heat and your eyes aren't closed with the smoke, it's easy to state the simple principles of a science, if that's what it is. All you're trying to do is force the fire into some opening at the top of the ridge that's covered with shale and rocks, or, if such openings don't abound in your vicinity, to force it into a thin stand of alpine pine or something that doesn't burn very fast. But with the inferno having arrived, and the smoke so thick you can only see two or three men ahead of you, it's gift and guts, not science, that tells you where the head of the fire is, and where an open ridge is that can't be seen, and where and when the wind will turn, and whether your men will have what it takes to stand and wait. Don't forget this last point when you place your men. It isn't just horses that panic when the barn burns. But we were placed right, and either we had guts or we were too sick to care. Anyway, we stood, and the wind stayed with us, and we crowded the big fire with our back fires and turned it into the timber line. But every time we got the fire under control, something strange would happen. The fire would jump our fire trench, usually at some fairly ordinary place. So we became sure that IWWs were rolling burning logs over the trench and starting the fire off again. If they were, it was probably just to keep their jobs going. But that wasn't what we thought. And anyway, it didn't matter much what we thought. The fire kept jumping the line everywhere until I and the red-headed kid were picked to patrol the fire. The fire foreman told us to carry revolvers. That's all we were told. I still ask myself why the two youngest in the outfit were given this assignment. Did they think we were so young that we would make a big show of ourselves but would freeze in the clutch and wouldn't shoot? Or did they think we were so young we were crazy enough to shoot almost sight unseen? Or did they think that nobody, especially the IWWs, could answer these questions? Anyway, we patrolled miles and miles through burning branches and feathered ashes so light they rose ahead of us as we approached. We didn't look for trouble, and we didn't find any. Also, we didn't pray, but finally the rains came. The other kid being red-headed, I think he would have shot. That wouldn't have left me much choice. I don't suppose Bill would have sent me up to the lookout if he knew how much I needed a couple of days' rest, a thought that gave me a good deal of pleasure. Still being sore at him, I reported by telephone to the ranger station the fewest number of times required, 3 times a day. The telephone, in a coffin-shaped box, was nailed to the tent pole and had a crank on it. 2 longs rang the ranger station, and 1 long and a short was my call, but nobody called me from the station. There was 1 woman on a distant lookout, and her call was 2 longs and a short, and I'm sure the rest of us lookouts often stood poised, ready to ring 2 longs and a short, but never did. Instead, we looked at her mountain and thought it looked different from other mountains, and we took off our telephone receivers and listened to her voice when it was her turn to report to the station. She was married and talked every night to her husband in Kuskia, but we did not listen to avoid feeling sorry for ourselves. After a few days of resting and not mending the tent, I started to feel tough again. I knew I'd been sent up here as punishment. I was expected to sit still and watch mountains and long for company and something to do, like playing cribbage, I suppose. I was going to have to watch mountains for sure, that was my job. But I would not be without company. I already knew that mountains live and move. Long ago, when I had had a child sickness and nobody could tell what it was or how to treat it, my mother put me outside in a bed with mosquito netting over it, and I lay there watching mountains until they made me well. I knew that, when needed, mountains would move for me. About the same time, I began to have another feeling, although one related to the feeling that I wasn't going to let Bill punish me by making me watch mountains. Somewhere along here, I first became conscious of the feeling I talked about earlier, The feeling that comes when you first notice your life turning into a story. I began to sense the difference between what I would feel if I were just nearing the end of a summer's work or were just beginning a story. If what were coming was going to be like life as it had been, a summer's job would be over soon, and I would go home and tell my pals about the big fire and packing my 3220 on the fire line and the dynamite. Looking down from Grave Peak, though, I was no longer sure that the big fire was of any importance in what was starting to happen to me. It was becoming more important that I didn't like the damn cook, who was nobody, not even a good or bad cook, and could do nothing well except shuffle cards. Faintly, but nevertheless truly, I was becoming part of a plot, and being made the opponent of my hero, Bill Bell. In fact, mysteriously making myself his opponent. The cook began to look like the mysterious bad guy. Even I became mysterious to myself. I was going to show a ranger and a cook that I couldn't be defeated by being made to watch mountains, which were childhood friends of mine. It doesn't take much in the way of body and mind to be a lookout. It's mostly soul. It is surprising how much our souls are alike, at least in the presence of mountains. For all of us, mountains turn into images after a short time, and the images turn true. Gold-tossed waves change into the purple backs of monsters, and so forth. Always something out of the moving deep, and nearly always oceanic. Never a lake, never the sky. But no matter what images I began with, when I watched long enough, the mountains turned into dreams, and still do. And it works the other way around. Often, waking from dreams, I know I have been in the mountains, and I know they have been moving, sometimes advancing threateningly, sometimes creeping hesitantly, sometimes receding endlessly, both mountains and dreams. In the late afternoon, of course, the mountains meant all business for the lookouts. The big winds were veering from the valleys toward the peaks, and smoke from little fires that had been secretly burning for several days might show up for the first time. New fires sprang out of thunder before it sounded. By 3:30 or 4, the lightning would be flexing itself on the distant ridges like a fancy prize fighter, skipping sideways, ducking, showing off but not hitting anything. By 4:30 or 5, it was another game. You could feel the difference in the air that had become hard to breathe. The lightning now came walking into you, delivering short, smashing punches. With an alidade, you marked a line on the map toward where it had struck and started counting, 1,001, 1,002, and so on, putting in the 1,000 to slow your count to a second each time. If the thunder reached you at 1,005, you figured the lightning had struck about a mile away. The punches became shorter, and the count closer, and you knew you were going to take punishment. Then the lightning and thunder struck together. There was no count. But what I remember best is crawling out of the tent on summer nights, when on high mountains autumn is always approaching. To a boy, it is something new and beautiful to piss among the stars. Not under the stars, but among them. Even at night, great winds seem always to blow on great mountains, and tops of trees bend, but as the boy stands there with nothing to do but watch, seemingly the sky itself bends and the stars blow down through the trees until the Milky Way becomes lost in some distant forest. As the cosmos brushes by the boy and disappears among the trees, the sky is continually replenished with stars. There would be stars enough to brush by him all night, but by now the boy is getting cold. Then the shivering organic speck of steam itself disappears. By figuring backward, I knew it was the 25th of August when an unusually hot electrical storm crashed into the peak and was followed by an unusually high wind. The wind kept up all night and the next day, and I tightened all the ropes on my tent. Cold rode in with the wind. The next night after I went to bed, it began to snow. It was August 27th, and the stuff was damp and heavy and came down by the pound. Most of it went through the tear in my tent, but there was enough left over so that by morning you could track elk in the snow. I didn't think much of the immediate prospects of building a fire and cooking breakfast, so first I climbed to the top of the peak. When I looked, I knew I might never again see so much of the earth so beautiful. The beautiful being something you know added to something you see, in a whole that is different from the sum of its parts. What I saw might have been just another winter scene, although an impressive one. But what I knew was that the earth underneath was alive, and that by tomorrow, certainly by the day after, it would all be green again. So what I saw, because of what I knew, was a kind of death with the marvelous promise of less than a 3-day resurrection. From where I stood to the Bitterroot Wall, which could have been the end of the world, was all windrows of momentary white. Beyond the wall, it seemed likely, eternity went on in windrows of Bitterroot Mountains and summer snow. Even before I got back to camp, it had begun to melt. Hundreds of shrubs had been bent over like set snares, and now they sprang up in the air, throwing small puffs of white as if hundreds of snowshoe rabbits were being caught at the same instant. While I was making breakfast, I heard the tick-tock of a clock repeating, "It's time to quit. Time to quit." I heard it almost as soon as it began, and almost that soon I agreed. I said to myself, "You fought a big fire and packed a big gun." And I said, "You slit waxy sticks of dynamite and stuck detonation caps in them and jumped back to watch them sizzle." And then I said, "You helped Bill pack and you watched mountains by yourself. That's a summer's work. Get your time and quit." I said these things several times to impress them on myself. I knew, in addition, that the fire season was over. In fact, the last thing the ranger had told me was to come in if it snowed. So I rang two longs for the ranger station. I rang two longs until I almost pulled the crank off the telephone. But in my heart, I knew that the storm had probably blown 20 trees across the line between the peak and the station. Finally, I told myself to stay there until tomorrow, when most of the snow would be gone, and then to walk to the station and get my time and start over the hill to Hamilton. What I neglected to tell myself is that it is almost impossible to quit a ranger who is sore because you do not like his cook, or to quit a story once you have become a character in it. The rest of the day I straightened up the camp, finally mended the tent, and listened to the tick-tock get louder. I put the boxes of tin cans in trees where the grizzly bear couldn't get them. I'd seen him split them open with one snap to a can. It was nearly 10 o'clock the next morning before I started for the ranger station. There was no use starting until the sun had done some more melting. Besides, I decided to take along the tree-climbing outfit, with a faint hope that maybe the storm had blown only 2 or 3 trees across the telephone line. So, in addition to my axe and my own little odds and ends, I was walking bow-legged with climbing spurs and climbing belt, and was carrying insulators and number 9 telephone wire. I doubt if I had dropped more than 1,000 feet of altitude before I was out of the snow. Also, by then, I had chopped 2 trees that had fallen across the line and had made